on News Talk 1240 WRTA. It's the 11th hour, Doug Herendeen, and we have with us musicologist extraordinaire from Penn State Altoona, Jerry Zoltan. And Jerry, what are we listening to here? And you can tell us why in a second when you introduce our special guest.
Well, we are going back to 1957 with a group that everybody knows, the Del Vikings. Of course, we know their hits, like Come Go With Me and Whispering Bells. This was their third record on the Phoebe label out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it was written by our guest today, the great Pat DeCesar, who's come up to join us all the way from the Berg. Pat, of course, has had an incredible career as a producer. He has crossed paths with some of the greatest acts of rock and roll, and Pat is the man who brought the Beatles to Pittsburgh in 1964, and he's got a new book out.
Yeah. Hard Days, Hard Nights. From the Beatles to the Doors to the Stones, insider stories from a legendary concert promoter, Mr. DeCesar. Welcome to WRTA, and thanks for coming
in.
Thank you.
Yes. My pleasure being here. Altoona is one of my favorite towns.
Although I noticed you mentioned Johnstown a lot in the book, but I don't see a lot of reference to Altoona.
I did play the Jaffa Mosque.
Okay.
But I always promoted... used Altoona to advertise for Johnstown as well as Johnstown.
You know? Well, cool.
And I visited many radio stations here in these 50s to try to get my records played.
Probably WRTA as well at one point.
WRTA, yeah.
It's just that we were talking off the air, and it's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating story. But my first question was, do you have to be a masochist to go through this, to put yourself through everything in it? Don't get me wrong, it's a fun book, but I mean, good night, the stuff that you had to do just to get this to work.
Yeah, you had to be able to deal with aggravation and stress and mental conditions. You're right. Yeah, nobody normal would do this.
What was your entree into it? I mean, you were, I think, in the beginning, and we're talking about back in Pittsburgh in the 50s, and you were a teenager, and you managed to break into the business. Not only as a songwriter, but a little bit as a performer as well, no?
Yes. When I graduated from high school, I got a job at Westinghouse Electric. It was a really prestigious job. You know, I went to work with a tie, and my father worked for Westinghouse Electric. But I was there one day, and I knew I had to quit. I had worked at the Holiday House as a busboy prior to this, and I loved it. You know, when I was in high school working at the Holiday House, all the big names were there. And I'd work from 4 o'clock to midnight every day. I couldn't wait to go to work.
We'll talk about some of the people you saw there.
Well, Xavier Cugat with Abby Lane was like, without a doubt, the favorite. They'd play there constantly. Then later, like the Letterman was like a real favorite. They'd play for weeks, and they'd do a lot of bowling crowd banquet type things, you know. So, but Al Martino, Vic Damone, everybody that would play the Ed Sullivan Show played the Holiday House. Their capacity was 1,100, which was big for a nightclub. Prior to that, Lenny Lippman had the Copa on Liberty Avenue in Pittsburgh. And Lenny was famous for bringing acts like Ella Fitzgerald. Johnny Mathis worked for him. He'd play Johnny Mathis for $300 a week when his opening, when Johnny was just starting, you know. And then he'd have Johnny sign like a five-year deal to play for $300 a week, you know. But the Holiday House, when it opened with 1,100 seats, that they ran the nightclub business. Of course, there's no nightclubs today.
Yeah. The interesting thing is, it seems no matter what part in your life you're talking about in the book, you're thinking, wow, it can't get any better than this, but I want to do something more, but I don't know what, but it can't get any better than this. You, as long as you had that attitude, I think it might explain why you eventually succeeded doing all the concerts.
And, of course, at that time, rock and roll was really just breaking, and that seemed to be the direction you wanted to head in, no? Rock and roll?
Yes, there. You were considered kind of a degenerate if you were had anything to do with the rock business. And there was no one representing rock artists, so I opened up a theatrical agency, and I called it University Attractions, and I just dealt mainly with rock bands. I went to colleges, and they didn't want anything to do with rock. And
the devil's music.
It was the devil's music, right? They wanted folk or jazz. And then, but I really got started with the fraternities. They took the rock out, bands, you know.
Yeah.
I was fascinated to read in the book about the Pittsburgh rock and roll scene, which apparently was sort of centered at the Carlton House Hotel. And you met some remarkable people before their careers even got off the ground. I know Bobby Vinton, and I know, well, a guy named Luigi Sacco. Maybe you can tell us a little about them and Bobby Records in your own group, the Penn Boys.
Yes, you're right. You know, the Carlton House was the mecca of the entertainment business. I did not realize it. Mm-hmm. I met Jay Michael, who was the top disc jockey in Pittsburgh at WCAE Radio at a dance. He'd run these big teenage dances. And I told him about the group. And he got me an audition with a record label, and it was at the WCAE Studios. At the Carlton House. And so if you were anybody in the music business, you wanted to be at the Holiday House. So that's where the songwriters were, the publishers, the record companies, the radio station. So I went to the audition, and I was amazed just to be able to go to Pittsburgh. I mean, it's the first time I went to Pittsburgh.
Dressed up in your little outfits, thinking, well, this is what the big groups do. And
Doug, when we were there were all these groups that were so much better than us. They just blew us away, you know.
And this is the Penn Boys that we're talking about.
The Penn Boys, right. And the producer said to us, don't call us, we'll call you, you know. And I thought, wow, that's pretty good. He's going to call us, you know.
Your audition sort of went like some of the auditions in the first weeks for American Idol, where it's like, oh, this is more for entertainment value than it is for music.
Yeah.
And it was a dose of reality, I guess.
It was. And I went back to Jay Michael, and of course I said, oh, he said he's going to call us, you know, don't call him, you know. And Jay knew what that meant. I was too naive to know that. And he lined me up with another audition for with Phoebe Records, which was Joe Averbeck. And Joe liked our songs, the Penn Boy songs, but he didn't like the group. And he needed songs for the Del Vikings. So he recorded that one you just played, right?
I'm spinning.
But you did make a record with your songs. You were singing in the group, and the label was Bobby. That was your own label, and it was named after
Bobby Vinton. Yeah, one day after I got a job, I eventually got a job in the record business, right? And I became the very best floor sweeper and shelf stalker in the business. But I did that for about 6 months, and then the owner of the company asked me if I had a suit. And I said no, and he gave me $100, said, go and buy yourself a suit, a shirt, and tie. He says, on Monday, you're going to be our record promoter and salesperson. And that meant I got in my car, and I drove all around Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, New York. And I would come to towns like Johnstown, Altoona, Tyrone.
And State College. You're going out to State College, out to Youngstown, and then south.
Yeah, I would go out on Monday morning and stay overnight everywhere, and I would come home on Friday night, you know, after visiting all these radio stations. I was just in Wheeling Saturday night. We had a concert there, and I stayed at the McClure Hotel. And I told my wife, I said, you know, more than 50 years ago, I used to come here. The room here used to be $1.50 a night, and you used the restroom down the hall. That's where you took a shower, and it was a bath then, and you didn't have a bath in your room. And I said, it was $1.50. And sure enough, she's looking at the lobby, and they have this window case, and there's the sign, $1.50 a night, showers down the hall.
But, so how did you meet Bobby Vinton? What was that all
about?
Well,
when I got the job in the record business, I graduated from sweeping the floors to become the promotion man, like I said. And I was standing outside of our distributorship one day. It was in this kid come up in this 1957 Plymouth convertible, you know, and he was looking for my boss, and the boss wasn't there. And he's, hey, I want to get a record. How do you get a record out? And you know, you guys are a record company. And the person I was standing next to said, well, talk to Pat. You know, he has records out. He had the Del Vikings. And at the time, the Del Vikings record went to number one in Pittsburgh. And so Bobby said, you know, I have this band, come and see me. So I went to see him, and the girls just loved him. He was an instrumental band. I mean, he had a big band. He played sax, and his father had a band. And he said, hey, I have these two songs, Twilight Time and Hallelujah, I Love Her So. And I said, okay, so we put it out. And I was pushing Twilight Time, and I was getting local play because I'd come to stations like yours right here. And, you know, if I became friends with the jock, those days the jock could put the record right on and play it. And I got started getting the play, and then the Platters came out with Twilight Time. We didn't even know it. They, you know, the Buck Ram, the Platters, manager of Platters, he became a friend of mine, but he wrote Twilight Time. And and he was in the studio, and the Platters needed another song to finish the time they had in the studio. And Buck says, let's just do this song I wrote 10 years. It was a big hit 10 years prior with the Three Sons. So they put Twilight Time on the other side. The Platters did it. And they sent, the first thing they did was send a copy to Dick Clark and WFIL in Philadelphia. And Dick had the American Bandstand. And Dick's secretary's listening. She turns you the B-side on to Twilight Time, and which was the B-side of the record, right? And she loved it. And she said to Dick, you got to play this record, Twilight Time. And Dick put it on the air, and it went to a million seller right away. You
know? Yeah, I think the term is almost bigfooting, although it's not exactly how it's used these days. It's sort of like overshadowed anything else that was going to sound anywhere like that at the time. We're talking with Pat DeCesar. Jerry Zoltan is with us, bringing Mr. DeCesar in. Now, you're going to be at Penn State Altoona this afternoon.
Yes, we're going to be there at 1 o'clock. Free pizza, public welcome.
Oh.
Pat will be there to talk and sell books and sign them and talk all about things.
And tonight, you're going to be at Barnes & Noble, Logantown Center.
6 o'clock, we're going to do a book signing. Pat will be there to do a book signing. Yes, that's exactly right.
We'll continue with Pat DeCesar. The book is Hard Days, Hard Nights on the 11th Hour, News Talk 1240, WR.
Heavenly shades of night are falling, it's twilight time. Out of the mist your voice is calling, 'tis twilight time. When purple-colored curtains mark the end of day, I'll hear you, my dear, at twilight time.
On News Talk 1240 WRTA, the 11th hour, the Platters' Twilight Time. The one that ended certain aspirations of a particular version of that from Pat DeCesar. He's written Hard Days, Hard Nights. And by the way, the thing I have to remind people is, if you're saying, boy, that name is familiar, if you went to concerts, you probably saw his name on tickets, if you went to any of the Pittsburgh area concerts. But the thing I remember, having come into Pennsylvania in the 80s, I was working in radio in Williamsport, we get all these major concerts, and of course at the end of the concert announcement, a DeCesar Engler production.
Yeah, those were the days.
Yeah. So we sort of left this where you got big-footed on that. You started getting into other concerts. I don't know which direction you want to go here. We eventually are going to get to the story about bringing the Beatles in and all that, but talk about Baby Baby a little bit, and we'll go from there, I guess.
Well, you know, I began writing songs, and that's how I got in the business as a songwriter. And I formed this group called the Penn Boys, you know, and we were four white guys on the corner singing, you know, and worked our way into the studio. But after I did a few things with Bobby Vinton and had a few other songs out, we decided, okay, we're going to record ourselves. And we did this Baby Baby, and the disc jockeys were always friendly to me. I knew everybody from my job of going around. I knew all these radio stations, and at that time, the jocks had the freedom to play the records, not like today.
Yeah, well, I mean, in other words, there wouldn't be a set playlist, and people say, is that Payola stuff? No, it wasn't. It was not that nefarious. There was that, but this was just like, hey, I have this record. Yeah, this sounds pretty good. Okay, I'll put it on next. And that's unheard of now.
Yeah.
So, Pat, you wrote the song. You sing in the group. What was your singing part?
I was not a very good singer. Okay. I have this nasal quality, you know, but not a Luke Christie type talent. But and then I replaced myself because I was just, I was,
you know,
too
better
busy,
you replace yourself than somebody else replaces you.
You squeezed yourself out of the group.
Yeah, it's a pleasant way to do it.
Maybe we should hear a little of Baby Baby. What do you think?
I need you.
had her fight.
Tell me, Cecilia, that you love me, and I'll be happy for the rest of my life. Baby, baby, how I need you so. Come on, honey, and please don't let me go. I need you, darling. You're the one for me. You're the one, you're the one, you're the one.
Well, now I
need you in the morning and I need you at night.
I'll be mad if we had a fight.
Tell me, Cecilia, that you love me. For the rest of my life, baby, baby, how I need you so. Come on, honey, please don't let me go. I need you, darling. You're the one for me. You're the one. 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 You're the one.
No, you've not tuned over to Good Times, Great Oldies, 1370 WKMC down the hall. It still is News Talk 1240 WRTA in the 11th hour, and that was the Penn Boys, Baby, Baby. What year was that, Mr. Caesar?
1958. That's from my vinyl copy, vinyl junkie that I am. When do you suppose that was the last time it got full AM airplay? A long time ago, but it launched you into the direction of being a major promoter of music, including the Beatles.
Yeah, that
was amazing there.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I remember several times in the book you say people in your hometown thought, well, now you're rolling in the dough because you got these songs on the radio, and it doesn't quite work that way back then.
No, you never got paid. I never got paid for any songs I wrote or anything. People just didn't pay. You know, you talk to Tommy James, he sold millions and millions of records, and Morris Levy, who owned the record company, never paid royalties. There wasn't anything you could do about it.
And unfortunately, this was not a unique story. This was all over. This was going on back in the day. I mean, it was simpler to do these things, but at the same time, because of that, you weren't necessarily going to be able to retire on having done any of these songs. You were working in what was called a one-stop at the time. Where explain what that was, because that's also a bygone era.
Yes. Well, the way, you know, you think about all the independent labels there are in this country. So most of the records were made, the companies were in New York or Chicago or Philadelphia, but they needed distribution throughout the country. And if there were 100 different labels and you were a record store or you were a you had a jukebox route. I had customers had 1,000 jukeboxes on location. And well, the great thing about it, there was like 500,000 jukeboxes. So if you had a million seller, you want to create a million seller, you could sell 500,000 to jukeboxes. So I would concentrate on jukebox operators.
And you had to take care of all that, providing it in a one-stop, literally.
Well, so these guys, say you were a jukebox operator, yeah. And you had a hit on RCA Victor, a hit on Columbia, a hit on Warner Brothers, a hit on Epic. You were going all over town to pick up these records from all these different manufacturers.
Yeah.
So we come up with the idea, okay, we'll make it one stop. We'll charge you an extra nickel for the record. But all you have to do is come to our location.
And that seems so simple now, but it was
revolutionary.
A new idea at the time.
You're right, yeah. So I spent a lot of time doing that in the one-stop business. I still had to promote and sell records, but it just made that more convenient.
Yeah, and we'll get from that to the Beatles. We'll get more of Into the Beatles after we take the break for the news here. But when did you have the first idea? You talk a little bit about it in the book, but when did you have the first inkling, you know, I could put together one of these shows. I could make some money here. Now, we're not talking Beatles. We're talking earlier.
Tuesday, May the 8th, 1962, Youngstown Stambaugh Auditorium, The Four Freshmen.
and you'll never forget that.
Never.
What made you think you could pull that off?
Well, I went to college, and you know, we paid a $35 student activity fee, and for that we got basketball and football tickets. And I complained to the faculty advisor and saying, I don't think it's fair that we students have to pay this activity fee and all we get is basketball or football. And she said, well, what do you think we should get? I said, concerts. She said, I never thought of that. She said, how would that work? And so I started talking to her, and she said, well, okay, you put together a show. But it has to be, you know, it can't be this rock and roll.
Uh-huh.
So I come up with the Four Freshmen.
Yeah, which some people probably figured was rock and roll, but not as perhaps they were afraid of at the time. It was acceptable to everybody. Well, most to everybody. I'm sure there are still some people that were offended by that idea. But it was a success for you then.
It launched me into, you know, I knew I could produce a concert. I didn't know what I was doing, but, you know, the guy at the hall said, well, is this GA or what? And I thought, what does GA mean, you know? And he said, well, do you want to have reserve tickets or general admission? I said, oh, he says, forget about it. Just have reserve tickets, you know. And then he said, who is the sponsor? And I said, what does that mean? He said, well, who's gonna sponsor? I got to put a name on this. He's, what's your name? I said, Pat DeCesar. He's, okay, we'll say Pat DeCesar presents the Four Freshmen. I said, wow, that sounds real good.
And the rest is history. Again, the book is called Hard Days, Hard Nights. From the Beatles to the Doors to the Stones, insider stories from a legendary concert promoter. And Jerry Zoltan is with Mr. DeCesar. We'll continue after the news on News Talk 1240 WRTA. On the 11th hour, News Talk 1240, WRTA, Doug Herendeen, along with Penn State Altoona musicologist extraordinaire Jerry Zoltan, who has brought us a fantastic guest today, Pat DeCesar, the author of Hard Days, Hard Nights, From the Beatles to the Doors to the Stones, insider stories from a legendary concert promoter, and the days of doing all this in Pittsburgh. Jerry, where do you want to start on this? Because it's a great story of how... You think, okay, yeah, we'll just get the Beatles. Sure we will.
Well, I think one of the remarkable things about promoting and the sorts of things that Pat has done is vision. How do you know? You know, how do you take the risk? It's an incredible gamble. In 1964, the Beatles were, you know, brand new. People were already talking about their demise. But Pat, you had the wherewithal to see the possibilities. And you made it happen. You brought the Beatles to Pittsburgh in 1964, and maybe even the vision to make this one of the first stadium concerts. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. Well, you know what, Jerry? I was blessed to have this ability to not give up, to never to think negatively. I mean, it was a struggle. I came from the very, very poor background. And if you gave me any kind of opportunity, I'm gonna do it. Mm-hmm. Now, with the Beatles, I was a record promoter. And my job, as I said before, was to go to record stores and radio stations to get the records played. So I was, and there were other people who did this, other record promoters. And all of us guys who were record promoters, we all had groups. We all were songwriters as well. And like Nick Cenci produced the Vogues and all the Luke Christie hits. And Joe Rock was a promoter. He did Since I Don't Have You for the Dow Vikings. And
The Skyliners.
The Skyliners, and I did, thank you, I did the Dell Vikings, and Frank became Michael Jackson's manager, and there were just so many good guys. But we were friendly competitors. So one day I am out, it's in 1963, and one of the guys said to me, hey, why don't you listen to this song, tell me what you think. And he played me Love Me Do, and I said, wow, that's really a great song, how you doing with it? And he said, I can't get this record played. And he said, no one wants to play it, and I'm not selling any records. And I said, who does that? And he said, the Beatles. I never heard of them, you know? So he said, I got this other one here, you know, and he plays She Loves You. And when I heard She Loves You, that really did it for me. You know, the yeah, 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 I was captivated. And I said, that's fantastic. You know, how are you doing with that? Can't get it played. No one wants to play the Beatles. So that's what it was. Then he had P.S. I Love You. And so I saw her standing there, and he couldn't get any of those things played. So I went back to my office, and the guy that I worked for, was a concert promoter in town. At that time, a concert promoter meant that he did no more than four concerts a year because they thought that's all the entertainment dollars there are. And ticket prices were $1.50, $2.50, and $3.50.
And this is in Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh, yeah. And, you know, you just didn't feel there were that many entertainment dollars around. So I went to Tim, his name was, and said, hey, I heard this group. I want to bring them into the Civic Arena. Now, at this time, the Civic Arena was just being built. It was just built. It was it had 12,500 seats, and that was considered entirely too big for a venue for music. That would be all right for basketball, ice capades, wrestling, but you would never think of doing a concert there. So I said to him, I want to do this act. And he said, what hits do they have? I said, well, they really don't have any hits, you know. He says, well, you got to be crazy, you know, to think about going to the Civic Arena. I said, yeah, but I think by the time we could get them here, I think I can make those records hits. And he said, well, I think you're crazy, but I'll call. So he managed Lou Christie at that time. Lou Christie had all those big records, Two Faces.
Lightning Strikes and right. All of that good stuff.
And Lou was a big act, and he did a lot of Dick Clark bandstands touring. And he was represented by the William Morris Agency, the largest theatrical agency there is. And Rosalind Ross was his agent. And I asked him if he would call Rosalind and ask her about the Beatles. So when he called her, she said, who's the act? And he said, the Beatles. And she said, I never heard of them. And where are they from? He said, England. He said, England, forget about it. You know, no English act has ever been big rock act in America. Americans just don't like British rock. They think they're corny, and that's the truth. That's the way I felt about them.
That's how it was at the time. You know, Cliff Richard and people like that. We were into our homespun music.
Right. So I asked her, well, call your London office. When she called the London office, they confirmed, yeah, all those hits are number one in England. But how big is England? You know, like the size of Texas or something, you know? And the Beatles would not want to think about coming to the U.S. Every act there is in the world wants to be number one in America. That's everybody's dream. But they weren't coming to the United States until they were number one. So they weren't going to do it. So nothing happened. That was November. That was around the time John Kennedy was killed, November of 1963. And now, at this time, the Beatles had those records were released by VJ Records and Swan.
Right.
Very small independent labels. And you know, unique thing, a side story. The Beatles had a 5-year arrangement with VJ. Everything they produced in England would go to VJ Records. Now, VJ didn't even want them. Now the only way that VJ took the deal was the attorney for Capitol Records in England was the same attorney for VJ. And Brian Epstein said, listen, get me a deal with any American company. They don't have to pay us anything for the masters, but every time they sell a single, pay us 8 cents. So he got the deal.
Which is amazing because VJ was a rock. It was an R&B gospel black artist label. The idea that they would be one of the first labels of release of the Beatles. Now, but eventually you were able to make it happen. And I laugh. I'm thinking about when Saturday Night Live offered the Beatles $100 or something to reunite, and it was a joke because the money was so small. What was the money like to bring the Beatles here? And what did you have to do to make that happen?
Well, here's what happened now. December 27th. Now VJ ends up losing the Beatles. VJ owed the Beatles $800 for royalties. And when they sent the check, it bounced.
Oops.
Yeah. And that Brian dropped VJ. But now he forced Capitol Records to come out with the album. And on December 27th, 1963, Capitol Records released the first album, Meet the Beatles. And on the first cut, on the first side, was that song you just played, I Want to Hold Your Hand. And the only way, that was such a smash hit, instantly. Everybody felt about the Beatles then, when they heard that, the way I felt when I heard She Loves You. Mm-hmm. And it was just like Beatlemania set in. Capitol Records sold 850,000 copies of that LP in 10 days. It came out December 27th. They were upset because they couldn't get it out before Christmas for all the Christmas business. And they thought, well, we're not going to do well with it. It sold 850,000. That's unprecedented, okay? And, you know, I told you guys when I was working in the record business, I worked for certain record companies. One of my companies was Coral Records, Coral in Brunswick, and we had Buddy Holly and the Crickets. When Buddy Holly had a million-selling single like Peggy Sue or That'll Be the Day, you sell a million singles, the most we could sell for an album across the country with Buddy Holly would be 50,000 copies of an LP. Here's the Beatles selling 850,000. They go from nobody wanting to play their records to having this smash album. It was just unprecedented. There's never been anything like this again in that time.
So eventually you get the opportunity to have the Beatles come in, and this involves needing $5,000 quick.
Okay, so after it was December 27th, and then at that time, Ed Sullivan was in London at the airport. He sees this massive crowd of kids. He drives. He tells his limo to go over there, limo driver. He meets Brian and makes a deal for $1,200. They do three TV shows. February 9th, 1964, Ed Sullivan show. 72 million viewers tune in. Instantly, Beatlemania sets in. So now I call the agent back and says, the Beatles are surely number one in the United States. I want to do a date in Pittsburgh. They said, well, why should we do a date for you? You know, you're unknown. You're this young person. You know, we don't know if you have the wherewithal to do this. You know, we got all these national promoters, all these guys with big money, offering big money. You know, I don't think they're going to do the date for you. So I says, well, would you go back and tell them that I was a guy in November that called when nobody knew who they were? So she came back and said, okay, the next day. The Beatles will do it, but here's the two conditions. Number one, and at this time, the headliner, any headliner for a major concert, got $3,500 a night. That was the American headliner. She said the Beatles want $35,000 a night. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of money today, but that's 10 times. That's like, I just made an offer to Bruce Springsteen for $1 million. They came back and said to me, you know, it might be 5 or 10 million for what I wanted to do. I mean, that's astronomical. You're going from a million to 10, and that's the way 3,500 to 35,000 felt. That was number one, which meant I'd have to have a ticket, high-priced ticket price. So the second thing she said is, you got to get $5,000 cash, put it in a brown paper bag, and deliver it to a bartender at the Club Elegant in Brooklyn, New York, and you got 48 hours to do it.
That's incredible.
You know,
oh, that sounds legit.
Well, you know, I mean, the first thing was I didn't have $5,000 cash, but I never thought that that was unreasonable. That to put that 5,000 cash in a brown paper bag and deliver it to a bartender. I didn't think, you know, I was, but the point is, you know, would you do it? Would you do it? Would you have done it? Would you have done it?
I don't think I would have had the constitution or the stomach to do it.
I might have. I'd have tried.
Well, first thing was I didn't have $5,000.
Yeah.
I didn't know where to get $5,000 either. But I did not let that stop me. And that's something that I teach today about, you know, you just can't give up at the slightest. You're always going to have obstacles, okay? So I had 48 hours to raise the 5,000. I spent the whole day. I went to jukebox operators. These guys had slot machines, poker machines, nothing but cash, right? And I figured they'd go for this, be my partner.
No,
they said, are you crazy? That's the biggest scam there is. You got to be crazy to give somebody $5,000 cash. So I went to radio stations, record stores, and anybody that was in business, nightclub guys, bars, nobody would give me $5,000. So I lived at home with my mom and dad. I drove home. I'm telling them the story I tell you, and, you know, they don't know who the Beatles are. So the next day, I go drive into Pittsburgh, go to work, try to raise the money. I can't do it. The end of the day, I drive home. I only have a few more hours. My 48 hours are going to be up. And I went home with my mom and dad, and we're eating at the table, and we're done eating. My dad slides an envelope over to me. Now, my father my mother and father had 10 kids. So we lived in a two-bedroom house. my brothers and I lived in the attic. We had no heat, no hot water. Okay. And my dad never made $100 a week. So he slides this envelope over to me when we're done eating. I open it. I pick the envelope. There's a check made out to me for $5,000. I said, Dad, where'd you get this? He said, at the credit union in Westinghouse Electric, I got a loan on the house, and I put the house up as security. I said, Dad, I can't take your $5,000. I got to give this to a bartender in Brooklyn. And he said, do you believe in the Beatles? I said, yes. He said, well, then go do your Beatles. And that was the last I heard of it, you know. And that the greatest gift was my father believing in me. And that happened for the rest of my life with him. Just so many stories about him. So we got the Beatles.
You got the Beatles. It was a huge success. The side note is you weren't there to see it.
You're right. I booked them in February for September, and on May 29th, Vietnam was a big deal in this country, unfortunately, and on May 29th, I had to go in the Army.
So, but the concert was a success, and I love the stories in the book where you're able to slide an envelope back more than once to your folks and say, thanks for believing in me, because that was just amazing. We're talking with Pat DeCesar. The book is Hard Days, Hard Nights. We have to take one last break, and we'll be back for just a few more minutes on the 11th Hour. News Talk 1240 WRTA. The 11th Hour, Doug Herendeen, Jerry Zoltan, and Pat DeCesar. The book is Hard Days, Hard Nights. And you're going to be at Penn State Altoona at 1 this afternoon.
We're going to be there at 1 o'clock. Free pizza, public invited, free, up in the Michonne Family Center. So come on down and meet Pat, and I'll be there too.
And also tonight at Barnes & Noble, Logan Town Center in Altoona.
Pat will have his books there. There'll be a signing at 6 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble. Yes, indeed.
We only have a few minutes here. There is an unbelievably detailed and fantastical story about getting Sly from New York to Pittsburgh for the show that he had booked, and there's no way we could do it justice here, but you have to read it in the book to really appreciate everything you went through. Do you think you're going to have a heart attack while you were trying to do that, sir?
Well, I was hoping not to, but I don't know.
I know, Pat, you had to literally fly to New York, stand next to Mr. Stone to make sure he gets on the plane to Pittsburgh. He was notorious at that time for not showing up. And, of course, it didn't go smoothly. But the beauty of the book is you tell all of these incredible stories in there. And, of course, the whole idea of being a promoter and the stress and the aggravation. I think the concert you did with Janis Joplin in Pittsburgh was something that put a real strain on your work as a promoter of that show. Maybe you can tell us a little of that.
Yeah, you know, they came in. Janis came in during the cultural change in the U.S. That's a time when we were still going from AM radio to FM, and that in itself was alarming. But it was women's liberation, the Vietnam War protesting. I mean, it was a horrible time in the country. And a lot of this outrageous actions were dealt through music and concerts. And people just, were anti-establishment. And Janis was the first one that, when I booked her, I didn't know what she was going to be like. But when I do a concert, I was always in the dressing room, in the box office. I hate to admit this, but I grew to hate the artist. I mean, I know that's not a popular thing to say, but the bigger the artists were, the more I didn't want to be associated with them. I didn't want to take a picture with them. I didn't want to go backstage. So I spent my time in the box office. But you had to take care of business, and that's where you paid everybody. There were hundreds of people on the night of the show that you had to pay. So I spent a lot of my time in the box office, and I thought I had to do everything myself. Today I have an accountant that does that, But I got a call from one of my runners, said, hey, you got to come backstage. And I says, what's the problem? Do you know what the problem was?
Yeah, she was involved in something at the time that was not part of the show.
We can't mention it.
We can't mention it, but you can draw a conclusion there. And it's spelled out in the book pretty well. But the thing that got me was there was this one woman you mentioned at the venue who was always in charge of these things, and they always wanted you to go out on stage, whether it was Richard Pryor, Janis Joplin, or any of these other people. You tell them to stop using that language. You tell them to sit down in their seats. Yeah, and they actually expected you to go out and stop the whole show and get them to, I don't know, sit there like an oil painting. Which was and for some reason they kept letting you back in, I guess because, oh, I don't know, the show's made money. Have something
they
to do with that.
Rent. Yes.
You had to go out there with Janis.
Janis, like he's talking about Richard Pryor, Bette Midler, you know, and you can't talk to an act when they're in the middle of their performance and say, hey, you got to stop using that language. You know, they didn't want to hear that.
Yeah. And the other thing that we really don't have time to get into, but the next time you go to a stadium concert, yes, the Beatles had done Shea Stadium, but as far as the modern stadium concert and how in the world you do it, well, it's just accepted now. But Alice Cooper in Pittsburgh was your deal. And just that story alone out of the book could be a 2-hour motion picture of how you didn't end up putting a bullet through your head, having to deal with everything that could possibly go wrong going wrong in that case.
1972.
Yeah.
Hurricane Agnes.
Yeah. Just happened to show up at the same time as Alice, which probably ticked him off more because he couldn't go out and play golf at the time if there's a hurricane going on. Pat DeCesar, what are you doing these days, just quickly?
Well, I still produce concerts. I do what I call Relive the Beatles 64. And this year, this September will be the 51st anniversary of when I brought the Beatles in. So I have a great Beatle act called Beatlemania Now. And I have the Beatles and the artists who influenced them, which is like Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis, Buddy Holly, Elvis. And this year it's going to be at the Palace. Maybe one of these years I can bring it here to Altoona.
Hey, wouldn't that be a bad idea whatsoever. Pat DeCesar, Hard Days, Hard Nights, from the Beatles to the Doors to the Stones, insider stories from a legendary concert promoter. Jerry Zoltan, thank you very much for arranging all this.
My pleasure.
And we'll just go out with a little bit of Alice Cooper. We'll have a podcast of the program up later today on the 11th Hour page at WRTA.com. Thanks for listening.